This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to what is actually the 150th episode of the USDF's official podcast. So we do want to start by thanking all of you from wherever you are in the world who have taken the time to listen to this podcast and support it over the past years. And we hope you find it both entertaining and educational at the same time. And as a celebration of our anniversary, at the end of this podcast, we'll have details on how to enter a special drawing. And before I tell you who's going to be on this week's episode, I'd like to remind you that the views of the guests and the host of this podcast don't necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. And our guests this week include the USDF Senior Dressage Judge, Kathy Rouse. She's here to share some of her pet peeves from a judge's point of view. In our education segment, Jen Vaharan will offer the final part of our Strategic Planning for Riders series. And finally, as we continue our American Legends series, we'll be reflecting on the career of the 2002 Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame recipient, Lizelle Nock. But we begin with a couple of items of news for you, and the first is for competition management, FEI judges and competitors, and freestyle designers. The FEI dressage freestyle tests have now been updated to allow for 0.1 decimals for the artistic marks. The revised tests can be found on the FEI website. Competition management is asked to make sure that you have the current test sheets for your competition. The 2017 USDF Online Stallion Guide is now live. This annual online guide is released by the USDF for the dressage community, and the guide is available either through the USDF website and the USDF app. This guide contains interactive links to give all the information you need to make a favorable breeding decision. And whether you're interested in breeding or looking for a breeder with offspring already on the ground, this is a great way to learn more about dressage breeders throughout the North America continent. And now we welcome back Kathy Rouse, the USCF Senior Judge, to talk about her pet peeves. Well, this is about pet peeves of a dressage judge, but is it really, Kathy?
You know, Chris, I'm so glad you brought that up because, no, for me, it's not so much about pet peeves as it is about things that we see over and over that are really preventable or they're fixable. So to start that off, I guess the biggest pet peeve I have for the entire sport is people who don't seek out education. There's so much education available, many of them from USDF, and often at no cost. These are great opportunities for riders of all levels, whether the professionals, juniors, adult amateurs, anyone who wants to learn and who rides can learn by studying. And that often, that knowledge is makes it easier to apply. It's hard to do something that you don't mentally understand. Just a quick note that the articles in the USDF Connection are really good every month. Do you take time to sit down and read them? This is really one of our professional journals, and there's great training articles and series in them. Since it's a new year, it's a good time to sit down and assess where you're at with your own riding, develop your goals, and most importantly, develop your plan to achieve them. Put down the educational opportunities that you want to utilize right now. So as a judge, I actually feel really bad if I have to give low scores. Because unfortunately, in my opinion, the competitor has not successfully demonstrated the requirements of the purpose of the level. And you know, I know the rider's disappointed. Sometimes they can even become discouraged, which we never want to happen. So I'm going to talk about a few things you can do to make the judge's day. The very first thing you can do to improve is to read, study, and I'm going to challenge you to commit to memory this year the purpose of the level that you plan to show at. Then read and study the basics and criteria that are on each movement of the test you'd like to do. Most people are surprised that the test sheet alone gives you a great deal of information about what we're looking for and how you can avoid the pet peeves. To help you understand better, you could even find videos on YouTube of really good horses and riders doing the level or the test that you plan to do, and study how they look. Look at the impulsion, the harmony, contact, use of the top line. Oh, and the rider's position and how they influence the horse. Don't want to forget that. Look at the horse's cooperative teamwork with the rider. This is learning by seeing. You want to play that video in your mind as you ride and train every day. Go back and watch it often to reaffirm. Of course, I know that the show environment is stressful. So to be successful, you have to have really confirmed basics. They should be secure and confident in order to move up to a next level in 2017. If you want sevens in the ring, you really need to be honest and say, are you riding eights and nines at home every day? I know that not all horses are brilliant movers, but almost every horse can improve the quality of the gates. There are really three places that I want to talk about that I feel riders neglect in the ring. And this can easily become a pet peeve of any judge. That is, for me, the non-brilliant move, the stretch circle, and a certain transition. The non-brilliant moves are halts, turns on the haunches, and walk pirouettes. Ride the non-brilliant moves brilliantly. I hate when people lose points on these because it's so preventable and fixable, as I said. But to do these, you need to practice them a lot. You start by breaking down each part of the movement, get each piece of the part for a 10 before you even try to put the pieces together. For example, let's look at the entry, the halt, and the move off. First, you practice riding a very straight line on the center line. And you want to make sure you have perfect turns on the center line. For example, at the end of your test. Practice your halts on the rail, then on the quarter line, then center line. Practice your salute so the horse doesn't move off or move or come off the aids during the salute. Then finally, you'll put it all together and make a great impression on the judge. The next area, which probably is a pet peeve for just about all of us, is the stretch circle. Honestly, it's been in the test for almost a decade, and it should be a key basic part of training every day. Horses at all levels should use the stretch as a way to warm up, cool down, relax the muscles, and improve the quality of the gait every day. But in the ring, riders still don't demonstrate a very good understanding of what they need to do. So I'm pretty sure they're not doing it correctly at home either. This year, resolved to read the rule book. Memorize what's required under the stretch circle. It's not a gravity stretch. Watch videos of good stretch circles. You'll see that it's both down and out, not one or the other. And it should be on a light contact, where the use of the top line and the quality of the trot should improve. When you look at the video, ask yourself, gosh, does the horse really reach for the bit and lift its top line, use its back, and lo and behold, the quality of the trot gets better. To me as a judge, being able to successfully demonstrate a stretch circle is a strong indicator of harmony and tells me that your training's on the right track. My third pet peeve. This is simple. It's a transition from free walk to medium walk, or extended walk to medium walk, or extended walk to collected walk. This transition is another strong indicator of harmony and the horse's desire to seek the contact. As a pet peeve, judges see horses that lose the rhythm. That's a cardinal sin, you know. They brace, they tighten their back and neck. Generally, they're being ridden backwards. It takes a lot of practice to make this transition fluid and clear, swinging, in general, seamless. The only other thing I'm going to pick on is the rider category. Any type of rough riding is just never acceptable. But sometimes unskilled or unstable seats, hands, legs, upper bodies, we see that. And it can be very distracting. And we know it can't clearly communicate to the horse or the judge. It's sometimes even difficult to watch. Again, as you start your video search, look for riders who follow their horse's movement effortlessly. Study their position, how they use their body. Now keep that beautiful picture in your mind. You'd be amazed at how much easier it is to replicate when you have a good picture in your mind, especially as you increase your education and experience. That beautiful, harmonious picture is what makes my day, Chris. So that's kind of it. Like I said, it's not really about pet peeves. It's really about what you can do to avoid falling in that pet peeve hole, because there's so much information I know everyone's going to have a great 2017.
That's great advice, Kathy. Good New Year's resolutions for everybody there to improve their test at their level. Well, thank you so much indeed for coming on the program. It was good to hear from you. Appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thank you. I always enjoy your podcast. Take care.
And you can find more pet peeves on the USDF's eTrack Dressage on the Go page on the website at usdf.org and on episode 145 of the USDF's official podcast. And now, in our education segment, Jen Vaharan is back with part two of the two-part series taken from the education session Goal Setting and Strategic Planning for Dressage Riders that took place during the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. Jen is a certified health and wellness coach, and she's here with more ideas to shift our thinking so that we can achieve goals we never thought we could.
There's two different ways to interpret fear. One is the fear of something that a phantom, of something that might happen, a fear of something, the boogeyman or a plane crashing or falling off your horse. Okay, that's one fear. And we are highly motivated by those fears in our lives. We set ourselves up to avoid things that we're afraid of. There's another kind of fear. This is the fear of becoming more truly yourself, inhabiting a larger space, accomplishing your goals, getting closer to who you really want to be. And there are two Hebrew words that are used to identify these two different types of fear in the Hebrew language. And we just don't identify them in our culture. So what happens for these people, all of us, who get closer to accomplishing our goals is that fear kicks in and we interpret that as a fear of something bad happening. And we see it as a red light, like, ooh, we shouldn't go there because it's not feeling right anymore. I feel afraid. So what I try to encourage people to do is to experience that as a green light instead. That kind of fear means go. And it's really challenging because you need to let people experience it. You need to let them have it. I needed to have my panic attack about doing this. And then I got past the fear of something bad happening, and then I could step into this idea that, well, this is an opportunity for me to inhabit a larger space than I have before. So with your students who do that, I would recommend letting them talk about their fears, letting them explain it, letting them cry, letting them shake, and then reconnecting them with what's on the other side. What is on the other side of this goal? What are the payoffs going to be? And you'll find over and over again that they'll be able to access courage once they have really identified that they're willing to push through that fear in order to get where they want to get. And this goal setting idea, it's a combination of creativity and commitment that give you the adversity to stick with your strategic plan, have a goal, and it's, I say, like flow like a river around all the stuff that comes your way. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage and creativity and strength to do that. But when you have a goal and you have a strategic plan and you're willing to brainstorm and you're willing to think outside the box, there is always a way. And sometimes it takes years. I mean, if you'd have told me when I was 19 it would take me till I was almost 40 to get my silver medal, I would have been like, oh my God. You know, but it made it all that much more worth it having gone through all of that. So I guess my answer would be similar, is to continually reconnect with what it means, why it's important, and keep looking at all your different options and make sure you've exhausted all your strategies before you ever think about giving up. When you have a fixed mindset, you believe that you do not have the power to change your circumstances or your situation. When you have a growth mindset, you are always open to the idea that you can adapt and change and learn. And I have an example for that. At the regional championships a few years ago, I was riding in the third or fourth level championships, I can't remember, and there was like a 9-point percentage point difference in the between the judges and my test. And the low score was a score I was not used to getting on this horse. And I was just like, you know, at first I was really ready to blame the judge and be upset about it and kind of be in this mode of, oh, I always have bad luck and blah, blah, blah. And what happened is that was a fixed mindset. When I really got a growth mindset about it and I really read the test and I really looked at it and it was really open, the judge with the low score was right. And that by being more open to the idea that I could change and improve and grow and take that feedback was really powerful for me, because it made me address things with that horse that I hadn't addressed because no other judge had really identified it for me. So if you, you know, have this fear of success or fear of failure, if you begin to look at every failure as a flashlight kind of shining you on those places where you need to grow or change or improve, it's a completely different experience of getting feedback. When you look at all the different ideas you have a client who has a 7-year-old mare, and she has a lot of issues with her own expectations. She wants to get the mare to Grand Prix. She puts a ton of pressure on herself. She feels very discouraged in every ride because she has all these high expectations for herself. And I asked her what her 3-month goal was going to be, and her goal for, this was last year, the last competition year, and she said, okay, I want to do third level by the end of the year. And then she said, no, I want to do Pre-St. George by the end of the year. So, and I can just say, oh, well, that's unrealistic, because that's not what this is about. So instead, I asked her to go home and look at the purposes of the levels on all the tests, training level all the way up through, and identify what she wanted to do in the next 3 months, not the full year, but the 3 months. And she came back and she'd read all the purposes of all the levels, and she said, I want to be able to ride a first level test and demonstrate the uphill balance, the elasticity and the connection, everything that was in the purpose of the first level. And both she and her trainer reported changed her experience of her riding, because no longer was she that rider that wasn't able to get to third level or Pre-St. George or Grand Prix, but she was this rider that was connected with the basics and where she needed to be at that point. And I bring this up because it's kind of like, you know, there's this anticipation of, oh, I've got to choose, I've got to figure this out. But when you really look at what's close in, it helps you stay really focused on the foundation of your project, and you're probably going to make a lot better decision and have a more successful project when you've done all your research. So that client was a great lesson for me, because it wasn't only about the importance of benchmarks and really being present with where you're at and what the next step is, but also as horse trainers, that's what we need to be doing all the time. Is we are always training to the Grand Prix, but we're also really focused on accomplishing all of those benchmarks that happen before we get there. Talked about this a little bit this morning too, is we, especially in our culture and especially in our industry, have a tendency to rely heavily on the idea of self-discipline and willpower. And we think we just have to try harder. We just, you know, this year I'm going to do it. I'm going to ride in 10 degree weather, blah, 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 blah. And we keep hammering the screw with the hammer. And then there's also what I call Groundhog Day, this when you don't follow through, when you don't ride, or when, like for me, my husband and I, it's when we drink too much wine and eat too much ice cream, and the next day you get up and you think, oh, I suck. I'm just going to have, you know, bacon for breakfast. You know, it's this story that we tell ourselves when we don't do what we set out to do that perpetuates that not riding. And what I would say too is to be really kind with yourself. And when it's 10 degrees and you don't ride, that's okay. That's part of the expectation. There's going to be days you don't ride, and to have a high level of self-acceptance around that, and that will make it easier for you to hold a higher bar for yourself more consistently. So we've talked about the resilience. When we're no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. So really always be thinking, what needs to change? When obstacles get in your way, like we were talking about earlier, really look, is it the time frame, the strategy, your perspective, or the goal itself that needs to change? Interdependence is really, really key. We are so conditioned to be independent that we forget the power of being interdependent and being symbiotic with others and both getting and giving support. And in terms of goal setting and keeping motivation, that's really, really important. The goal setting process results, and this is not just in accomplishing goals. When I start working with people and they begin this process, they feel empowered. They become internally directed and more connected with not pleasing others and worrying so much about what other people think and want, but being really clear about what they want, which is not selfish. It actually makes us have a larger capacity to give when we're really internally directed. Handling ups and downs with grace, achieving meaningful goals, and gratitude. All of these come as a part of the process. They don't just come at the end. And I just want to talk about some of the things that keep us from being in action. There are reactive beliefs and there are proactive beliefs. Almost everyone that I work with says on some level that procrastination is a problem for them. And one of the reasons it is we have some beliefs. Some beliefs I might have if I'm behaving as a procrastinator and I'm letting myself be stopped is I might think that fear means wait until you're ready. I might think that I need to wait for inspiration to hit. I might think that I work better under pressure, which is a big one. I might always be asking, how do I stay motivated? How do I stay motivated? How do I stay motivated? And I might feel like I'm at the mercy of my circumstances. The flip side of that is when you're proactive, fear means go. It's a green light. Action precedes inspiration. So I'm willing to be in action when I don't feel like it. When I'm not inspired, I'm willing to take action anyway. I value peace of mind. I like the place of having accomplished things and being at peace. I always am asking, instead of how can I stay motivated, I'm asking what action can I take? And I feel, instead of being at the mercy of my own circumstances, like I can create my own reality. And these are beliefs. These are not inherent qualities of a human being. We all can have proactive beliefs. Structure and accountability. We already talked about a lot of this. Let go of old stories. Take advantage of your essential nature. Follow your own energy. This idea of repeated recovery is natural. The most successful people I know who are constantly out there achieving, they're always starting over. They're always messing up and starting over. They're always falling off the wagon and getting back on. So it's not about getting on the wagon and staying there. It's not linear. It's about this constant willingness to get back on track. All right. So we set a meaningful goal, we created a strategic plan with strategies and action steps, and what I really would love you guys to take away from this is this idea that creativity and commitment work together. They are not exclusive. So the stronger your commitment, the more creative you have to be in order to get there. And action precedes inspiration, which is my mantra. This is a quote I want to leave you with. There's a little book called The War of Art, and Stephen Pressfield is a writer, and he writes about why resistance and procrastination keep us from living the lives that we're meant to live or that we really want to live. He says that we fear discovering that we are more than we think we are, more than our parents, our children, our teachers think we are. We fear that we actually possess the talent that our still small voice tells us, that we actually have the guts, the perseverance, the capacity. We fear that we truly can steer our ship, plant our flag, reach our promised land. We fear this because if it's true, then we become estranged from all we know. That idea that we fear change, we fear stepping into a larger version of ourselves. And I really love this that he identifies this, because by recognizing it, it gives us the power to change it and to move through that fear.
And if you missed the first part in this two-part series, you'll find it on the previous episode of the USDF's official podcast. That's number 149. And now, in our American Dressage Legends series, we're going to hear more about the 2002 Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame inductee, Lizelle Nock. Lizelle, the founder and past president of the USDF, has written numerous articles on dressage in equine publications. Her leadership and contributions to dressage include officiating at many FEI events in Canada and the USA. Lizelle helped to develop the USDF's instructor certification program and also helped to develop the USDF's L education program for judge training. She was a founder of the Eastern States Dressage and Combined Training Association. She has been an American Horse Shows Association and an FEI dressage judge and herself competed through Grand Prix level. The Chronicle of the Horse named Nock its 1993 Horseman of the Year and its 1994 Dressage Horseman of the Year. She received the S. Braley Gray Jr. Award, which is given to someone who has made pioneering contributions to U.S. dressage. And now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a thank you to our listeners as we celebrate our 150th episode. We have a special anniversary prize drawing, and you need to be on Twitter to do this. You need to tweet us at USDF by using the hashtag USDF150 to be entered in the prize draw. Again, tweet USDF and use the hashtag USDF150. And that does bring episode 150 to a close this week. We want to thank you wherever you are in the world for listening to the program. And don't forget that you can find more episodes, more education and information resources on the website at usdf.org. You can download this podcast from iTunes to any podcast app. And you can also find it on the website at the top of the homepage. I'm Chris Stafford, and the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.